From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a new report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum sheds a concerning light on the budget situation at Milwaukee Public Schools.
Then Ray Jivoff looks back on his first year as the artistic director of the Skylight Music Theater.
It's fun to talk about You're in Town and its dystopian themes, and it's kind of a questionable title, and it pushes the envelope on social and political issues. But then we also presented Annie. Real cultural whiplash, real contrast, really presenting the full spectrum.
Plus, Lake Effect film contributor Dave Lurson talks about the latest addition to the Star Wars franchise called Solo.
The film does give us many of the pieces of the puzzle, I guess, of what constituted his personality, of why he was the way he was.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee Public Schools have dealt with financial challenges for years. As state aid and property tax levels have fluctuated, enrollments have dipped, facilities have aged, and competition has come from a variety of places.
A new report out this morning from the Wisconsin Policy Forum suggests that storm clouds may again be on the horizon, even as the district's new interim superintendent works to avert painful cuts in the MPS budget for the coming fiscal year. Rob Henkin is president of the forum, and Ann Chapman is senior researcher. They spoke with Mitch Tyke about the outlook for MPS and the challenges they identified a year ago.
So last year was certainly not an easy budget for MPS. There were cuts of dozens of positions and certainly some severe budget pain. The good news, however, last year was that there were still a few budget maneuvers that had not been fully exhausted. And in using the term maneuver, Mitch, I don't mean to imply fiscal irresponsibility, but there were some surpluses from healthcare from previous years. There was some still ability to divert some property tax levy from the construction fund to school operations. Furthermore, because there had been additions to school budgets over the previous two budgets, when cuts had to be made in 2018, they weren't quite as painful because you were essentially cutting things that had been added in previous years. We warned, however, that all of that was going to run out and that if the trends that we were observing of stagnant or declining revenues along with rising healthcare costs continued into 2019, that 2019 was going to be an extremely difficult budget year, and that is indeed what has happened.
Well, and 2018 came on the heels of two what you would describe, I gather, as outliers, 2 years where things were actually in pretty good shape.
Yes. And again, it stems from some significant changes to healthcare benefits that both came about because of prior collective bargaining agreements, plus, of course, the enactment of Wisconsin Act 10. Not only were they able to see some unexpected healthcare savings in terms of the magnitude, but also the wave of retirements caused by Act 10 produced a positive fiscal benefit because they replaced older retiring teachers at the high end of the salary scale with new teachers at the lower end. And so those factors really provided some relief over a couple of years. So we had a couple of years of budgets that weren't so bad. Unfortunately, and one of the points we make in this report is that I think people sort of lost their eye on the ball and that the need to really still acknowledge that there were some deep structural challenges and consider some deep structural changes sort of fell by the wayside for a couple of years.
Well, and so let's talk about these deep structural challenges and the kinds of specific pressures that have come to bear in the 2019 fiscal year. Your budget brief points to six keys to understand what's going on. And honestly, I think the best way to understand is to go through each of those. So let's talk about, first of all, the kinds of revenues that the school district has to work with and the situation the district finds itself in as far as those revenues go.
Sure. So the main source of revenue for school districts all across the state and for MPS is property tax and equalization aids, and those come from the state. And the two of those combined make up what's called the revenue limit. What happened this year was that there was the state kept the revenue limit flat. So to the extent that equalization aids might have gone up, property taxes have to go down. And that's in fact what happened this year. So the vast majority of the way they get funded was relatively flat. It actually went down a little bit.
So to maybe oversimplify things, when we see that just because state aid goes up doesn't mean that overall aid goes up.
Yes. And that's it's a specific source of state aid, but it's the largest source of state aid. Yes.
Well, and so how big a role does that issue play in the financial situation that the district finds itself in?
Well, the main thing that is important to understand there is that revenue is driven by enrollment. So even if the revenue limit stays flat, that doesn't mean total revenues stay flat. So if enrollment goes down at MPS, the overall largest portion of their aid also goes down, and that is also what happened.
And so, yeah, so what we're looking at right now is a situation where enrollment has also gone down.
Yes, and there's a 3-year impact when enrollment goes down. So the bad news here is that not only are we seeing the impact of that in 2019, but we'll continue to see the impact of that in 2020 and I believe in 2021 as well.
So budgets as far as budgets go, the enrollment data today impacts
next year's per pupil revenue.
You mentioned the what people have termed the flexibility caused by the changes under Act 10. There's been some restructuring of employee health care costs and other benefits. Where do things stand as far as that goes?
So and this, Mitch, is something that we have observed in Milwaukee County, City of Milwaukee budgets as well. There's no question that the combination of Wisconsin Act 10 and a recognition that healthcare was such a big driver of local government and school district budgets. And it's hard to – again, I don't want to say that some of these changes would or would not have taken place with or without Act 10. But clearly, the combination of those two allowed many districts and many local governments throughout the region to make some pretty substantive changes to the healthcare benefits and realize some very substantial savings. The problem is that those are short-lived. So unless you want to go back and change your fringe, your level of healthcare benefit for your employees year after year, you're not going to continue to reap those savings year after year.
We've talked about this in terms of Milwaukee County's budget. A fair amount.
Exactly. And so, so you get an immediate benefit. If you use that benefit wisely, you can stretch it over a few years, which is what MPS did. They actually used that the benefit of these savings to invest in some new strategic initiatives and so forth. But again, now they're faced with a situation, and we've already had this debate at the school board level. Can they afford not to reduce their healthcare benefits given the magnitude of this challenge in their budget, but at the same time, can they afford to reduce them given the very intense marketplace for talent and their need to retain and attract high-quality teachers really comes at odds to this fiscal imperative to reduce healthcare spending.
Now, you talked about it in fiscal year 2018, there was still some ability to transfer some of the property tax dollars from construction to operating costs. Where does that stand for 2019?
For one more year, at least, the district, again, is going to continue this practice. So this is essentially the distinction between capital and operating. And obviously, MPS has lots of school buildings and facilities that need work, that need major maintenance. In an ideal world, you're putting $15 to $20 million into major maintenance every year, and you're using $9 or $10 million of property tax levy in that amount. A couple of years ago, they took the tax levy out. They replaced it with some borrowing proceeds. They had the opportunity to borrow at a very good interest rate, and in fact, I think at no-cost borrowing in a couple of different areas. And so they, in turn, used those property tax levy savings from the construction fund to contribute to school budgets, which was an effective strategy for a couple of years. But there comes a time when you can't – your level of borrowing runs into trouble, and so you want to put that property tax levy back. For the 2019 budget, they're not doing that yet, but this may be the last year that they're going to be able to continue that strategy.
Well, and where does enrollment come in this? Because there are clearly some buildings that are not as full as they used to be.
Right. So the district actually had a study done to sort of look at their facilities use and how efficiently they're using their buildings and facilities. And this long-range facilities study found that it's overall the district is under-enrolled. Now, there are some bumpy areas where some areas are over-enrolled. Some schools are overcrowded and other areas where schools are undercrowded. But overall, there's a huge amount of the facilities that are not being used. And so, in essence, what's happening to maintain those facilities is the district is spending a lot of money to support students that are no longer there.
In terms of being able to alleviate that particular issue and realizing that you're not necessarily making recommendations, but you know, one of the things that could come to bear in future years is some kind of consolidation?
The way the district talks about it is it could come in a number of forms. It could be consolidation. It could be, consolidating, refreshing, and sort of reconfiguring the way the schools are set up, repurposing some of the buildings to use for other things to have better efficiency. And that would take a huge amount of investment. And on top of that, it's not just about reconfiguring the facilities to make them more efficient. The condition of the facilities overall is very problematic, and the assessment of just bringing the schools up to a very sort of modest average of a good rating is millions of dollars.
So reconfiguring is not the magic bullet or the silver bullet that takes the construction needs down.
In terms of the short term, no, because of the upfront investment that may be required. Over the longer term, however, you know, certainly if you can reduce your footprint, you're going to reduce your ongoing maintenance needs, and you're also going to reduce some operations costs in terms of the cost of heating and cooling buildings, et cetera. But Anne's absolutely correct that that's going to require some upfront investment that would be a major challenge, and it doesn't necessarily reap huge savings right away.
What about in terms of positions? You mentioned there were some job cuts last year. The current budget calls for more job cuts, dozens of teachers and administrative staff. What kind of impact do those cuts have on the, you know, kind of long-term fiscal health of the district?
So in this budget, the district cuts 147 positions. Most of them, they are in the school buildings. So 125 of those positions are in the school buildings. And that includes about 80 teachers and a number of educational assistants. And so that is a way of being able to balance this budget, although they tried to spread the pain across administrative positions and school-based positions as much as they could. So that's going to affect class sizes a little bit. And just the overall school budgets, they're going to have to squeeze a little bit more this year.
Also, there are some cuts to essential services as well.
Right. So total cuts is 147. Okay. 125 of them were in the schools. And
whatever the remainder is.
Right.
we don't have to do the math right here. But so let's talk about what the upshot to all these, you know, six different areas is as far as the sustainability goes when it comes to MPS budgets. Where does this put MPS when we look at 2020 and the years beyond?
When we look at the long-term picture, and MPS has itself laid out a five-year forecast, and we continue to see this gap between the projected growth in revenues, and in this case, for the next 2 years, they're actually expecting additional declines in revenues, and these expenditure pressures. If healthcare goes up by the projected 7% per year, that's millions of dollars of additional money that they don't have because their revenue streams aren't increasing that they need to ostensibly come up with for healthcare. So something has to give there. Obviously, the priority among all MPS stakeholders would be that to the extent that you have to make budget cuts, so that you're doing those in ways that aren't going to impact teaching and learning in the classroom. So to the extent that you could modify your approach to providing transportation services, which is something that the administration has proposed, but something that admittedly causes real impacts to hundreds of students and their families, to the extent that you can find ways to reduce the cost of healthcare without necessarily impacting your ability to retain and recruit and be fair to teachers. These are things you want to look at first. But I think one of our overriding messages here is that the problem is of such a magnitude that we don't see any way going forward that cuts to teaching and learning can be avoided. And indeed, they're not avoided in the 2019 budget either.
And presumably those kinds of cuts impact enrollment going forward as well.
Well, that's sort of the vicious cycle, is that here's a marketplace, a very competitive K-12 education marketplace in Milwaukee. We've described the extent to which enrollment drives revenues, but revenues drive enrollment. And so if you can't make the investments you need to make in your human capital and in your facilities, how are you going to boost your enrollment and get yourself out of this vicious cycle?
So once again, as you pointed out in the 2018 brief, heavy lifting is required.
I would say, again, there are no easy answers here, and we are already observing a highly contentious, and understandably so, debate among the variety of MPS stakeholders of where to go. Our unfortunate message is that again, there aren't easy answers here. There needs to be some collective, collaborative, long-term planning. The issues need to be laid out not only for the stakeholders, but for the community and for legislators in Madison. And we all as a community really need to come to some decision here as to whether this structure needs to be fixed going forward or whether, for whatever reason, we're going to take some other approach to K-12 education in Milwaukee. I don't know what that other approach could be. We still have a system here that's educating 76,000 children per year. But again, this needs some realistic long-term fiscal planning to at least lay the options and the consequences on the table, and then we can go from there.
Rob Henkin, Ann Chapman, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mitch.
Ann Chapman is senior researcher and Rob Henkin is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about the forum's brief on the 2019 Milwaukee Public Schools budget.
The interview took place before some adjustments to the budget were made by the district's interim superintendent. The brief notes that a budget crisis may have been averted for the current year, but the longer-term outlook remains dire.
After a break, we'll catch up with Skylight Music Theater's artistic director, Ray Jivoff, to hear about the company's current production of the Tony Award-winning musical Urinetown, and also to learn more about what the Skylight has in store for next season. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Urinetown won 3 Tony Awards for Best Book, Score, and Direction of a Musical in 2002. The very tuneful satire takes on our legal system, social responsibility or lack thereof, corporate greed and mismanagement, and musical theater itself. Milwaukee's Skylight Music Theater closes out its season with a production of Urinetown that opened last Friday and runs through June 10th.
The end of this season also marks the end of Ray Jivoff's first official year as artistic director of the company. Jivoff had been acting artistic director for a year before that, and regular audiences will remember seeing him acting in many Skylight productions over the years. He joins me in the studio now. Ray, it's a delight to have you here. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, happy to be here because you just got a show up, and you're just telling me just before we turn on the microphones, this is only your third show that you've directed at the Cabot.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I did Jacques Brel is Alive and Well and Living in Paris. I don't remember when. And then I did Hair in the 2013-2014 season.
And now you're in town,
mm-hmm.
Which is not like, well, kind of like Hair in its subversiveness.
In its subversiveness, yes. But it is not like Hair in that it has actually a book. So it's the first book musical that I've done in the Cabot. Because, of course, Jacques Brel is a review.
Yeah, it's a cabaret review. Mm-hmm. And it's a lovely cabaret review. But as you say, you know, you kind of have to make up your own story to link the songs together.
Yeah, yeah, I enjoyed that one. I really like putting things in an order or reorder. And I certainly did that with Jacques Brel. I put it all in a different order.
So with Urinetown, we probably should say what it's about for people who don't know. And it is an unfortunate title, but a very funny one, given what the show is about.
Exactly, yeah. Basically, what it's about is a 20-year drought has been going on in this fictional community or the world, and a corporation now controls private water use, in particular the public amenity or the toilets. People need to pay in order to use the restrooms. And they're a big corporation who decides to increase their fees. And that causes a revolution on the part of the people.
And we should say that they're not allowed to just go anywhere, that there are big fines if they're caught not using the official facilities.
Yeah. I mean, it's more than a fine. It is, you know, they are taken to Urinetown with quotes around it, and we find out what that means to be taken to Urinetown in the second act. There's this realization of people disappear when they're taken to Urinetown. So infer what you like from that.
But we should say this is an incredibly funny show, and it is an homage. I think of it as an homage to musical theater because there's so much that the authors and composer actually drew from other musicals. You don't have to be in the know to enjoy this, but if you do, it's like added extra layer, you know?
It's true. Yeah, when you talk about the theme or what it's about, it sounds really serious and dark, and it sort of avoids or misses what the show actually is, which is really funny and a celebration of music theater, very definitely, yeah. And we took that and ran with it, and the musical theater references in our production are I think we've counted 19. So in the score, there absolutely are very significant and clear riffs on certain musicals. The opening of the second act is the bottle dance from Fiddler on the Roof. It sounds just like it. But we've gone further with getting as many references in as we can.
Which is so much fun, you know, and it's fun for the audience to go, oh, wait. I remember the first time I saw it, I didn't really know much about the show. And so I went with a friend who did know the show, who did not tell me anything. And I started getting all of those, either the musical reference or the acting, you know, the way the scene was set up or something. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, this is going to be fun. And it really is,
yeah.
If you know anything about musical theater.
Yeah, or yeah. Even just theater in general. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there are comic things written into the script, certain vocal reactions and takes that are scripted, that are right out of the Honeymooners or the Three Stooges kind of reaction. So that's right up my alley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of fun.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So this show ends your first season as the artistic director at Skylight. How has it been? How have you felt now that the season's over and you've had a chance to relax for a few days? You know, looking back at this year, how has it felt?
I think we all feel really proud of the season that we've presented. I think it's fun to talk about Urinetown and its dystopian themes, and it's kind of a questionable title, and it pushes the envelope on social and political issues. But then we also presented Annie. Real cultural whiplash, real contrast, really presenting the full spectrum. So it's been a really good year that I think all of us at the Skylight are really proud of.
Do you feel like you accomplished what you set out to once you were appointed the artistic director?
Yes. I think that one thing I really set out, all of us have set out to do, is to really reinvigorate the sense of hospitality and fun at the Skylight, both in the lobby and on the stage, just what we're doing and how we're doing it. And I think that we've achieved that. Yeah.
What have you changed in the lobby? That's an interesting thing to think about. Most artistic directors are worried about what's on the stage.
Oh, well, I think that we're really working on making sure that we are welcoming, that there are things going on in the lobby, that we're presenting other kinds of events in the bar, in the salon. But certainly that attitude of being in the lobby and welcoming people and having it be a sense of fun has been important.
Is the pressure off now that the building sale has happened? Is that feeling good, too, that you're just kind of free to really just explore the artistic stuff?
Yes. Yeah. I think that that was a very definitely a weight. Yeah. An arts organization also managing a building. It was a real split focus for a lot of people on staff and our budgeting process and everything. So, yeah, it's made a real difference.
Already? Because mm-hmm. this hasn't been that long.
It hasn't really been that long, no. But just knowing that that's somebody else is going to take care of the plumbing and the roof or whatever it is that's coming up as opposed to we have to figure out how we're going to be doing it. Because there have been, in the past, there's been plenty of putting things on the calendar like closing the building so we can open up the sidewalk in front of the building and redo it. And, you know, that happened about 10 years ago. And
oh, I remember when that happened. Yeah, that happened while I was here. Yeah.
Yeah. Big projects like that in maintaining the building are now somebody else's responsibility, which is great.
Which is lovely. Mm-hmm. Because it does. Like you said, you're an arts organization. You're a presenting arts organization. Your whole goal is to put on wonderful shows.
Mm-hmm.
that's what you should be focusing on.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And in terms of the staff and the people who were pulled in multiple directions for that, are they feeling the relief as well?
I think so. I certainly can't speak for them and how they feel, but I certainly
the mood
that's
in the
my
office
observation.
Is good.
Yeah. It just feels better to know that we're sharing that responsibility, or we have someone else to turn to for that kind of work.
So, looking ahead,
mm-hmm.
What are you planning for this next season? Now that you've wrapped up this with You're in Town, you're taking the summer, deservedly, a little bit of a break.
Mm-hmm.
But I know planning goes on all year round.
Oh, sure. Yeah, planning goes on all year round, and we're well into planning and, beyond planning, contracting for next season. I think we've got a really great season planned. We're starting with Pippin, which is a 70s show by the composer of Wicked and Godspell. It's a great show that will again feature our Bobby Strong as Lucas Pastrana. And before I cast him in You're in Town, I cast him as Pippin. So he'll be back in the fall. And it's a beautiful, kind of magical show that really focuses on dance and storytelling. And then our holiday show is Hairspray, which I'm really excited about. I love the show. It's really funny, and it has a great point. It's similar to You're in Town in that way, in that there really are social and political issues that are dealt with in the show.
Quite a few of them.
Yeah. But it's really funny.
Yep.
And great music, and it's really entertaining. So you don't feel that you're burdened with we're struggling through these issues.
Being bludgeoned with it, yeah.
Hopefully there's ways to face and deal with issues in a positive way and not get bogged down in the weight of it. And that's another show that the story is told through dance, and dance is a part of the way things are solved. So it's another dance show. And then Five Guys Named Mo is our February show. It's a review. It features six men performing the music of Louis Jordan, whose nickname back in the 40s and 50s was the King of the Jukebox. He was a rhythm and blues swing composer and performer. Really funny, really great songs that really capture the culture of Harlem in the 40s and 50s.
And those tight harmonies.
Really tight swing harmony and great swing dancing to go along with it.
So delicious. Well, one of the things you've also done this past year is had this really nice sort of mini collaboration with an arts organization like Milwaukee Opera Theater, because I know Tales of Hoffman was a co-production.
Mm-hmm.
Do you envision more of those kinds of things in the future?
Absolutely, yeah. That's the next show in our season. After Five Guys Named Mo, we're presenting Carmina Burana. In partnership with Milwaukee Opera Theater and Jillian Aponisek, who is the artistic director of MOT and is an artistic associate at the Skylight. So she's got a desk and she spends time at the Skylight and has been really instrumental in turning things around and opening up the discussions of where the Skylight is going and the kind of programming that we do. And she'll be directing Carmina Burana, and it's in partnership with DanceWorks and Chant Claire, which is a choral group that started in Eau Claire or with alum of Eau Claire. So that's going to be a really exciting production that again incorporates both music and dance in a really important way.
And for people who are thinking Carmina Burana, they only know like the one, you know, the dun, one dun, 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 dun. Yeah. Yeah, that one. It is an amazing, again, slightly subversive piece. If you see the whole thing, there's a lot going on in that that is and can be a lot of fun and also pulls you in and you, makes you think, huh. So mm-hmm. I think that fits nicely into what you're describing.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about that it's a piece of classical repertoire that we are, I think it's something that we do well, which is to take something and to reinvent it, especially the classical rep. I think that there's more room for rediscovering things, like our Tales of Hoffman, which was, the music was reimagined, the casting was reimagined so that women were singing pants roles, roles were doubled, and how the story was told by one singer playing the villain and the next role was just so imaginative and creative. And I think that's a specialty of Joanna and Milwaukee Opera Theaters.
Well, and now Skylight as well.
Yeah,
because,
exactly.
You know, you guys are an integral part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what are you closing out the season with next year?
Well, we've added a sixth show on the Cabot stage, which is Things That Go Ding. We're bringing that back. That's been done in the bar twice and once in the studio theater. And we want to put it out on the Cabot stage to give Mike Ding Lorenz, our resident percussionist, all the room he needs to display and play his amazing collection of vintage tuned percussion. So that's between Five Guys Named Mo and Carmina. And then we close out the season with Kiss Me, Kate.
Another classic.
Another classic. We're doing it Skylight style, which means with a cast of 14, meaning people will be doubling and tripling. Other than the four main characters, everyone else will be playing multiple roles. It's another show that relies on dance as a main component. And Amy Brinkman from DanceWorks is choreographing that. I'm real excited about that. A show that Skylight's never produced, but is a perfect fit for Skylight in terms of the music, that it is Cole Porter in his swingy, sassy manner, but also Cole Porter in a very legit, romantic, lyrical manner, coupled with Shakespeare. There's Shakespeare text in the show. It's about a theater company putting on a production of Taming of the Shrew.
Brush up your Shakespeare.
Exactly, yeah.
One of the
11
great,
o'clock number.
Yes, exactly. One of the great, great sort of show-stopping numbers from that. Are we going to get to see you on stage at all in the next year or so, or are you too busy with all of the behind-the-scenes stuff?
I will be in Things That Go Ding.
Excellent.
I'm the guest singer in that. So that is Mike on percussion, and Jamie Johns is coming back to play piano. Yep. He's done it two of the three other times. And then I've been in it all of its iterations as a guest singer. So I pop in and out. And in the past, I've done a medley of Gilbert and Sullivan tunes. I don't think we're doing that. I think we're doing show tunes instead. And Jamie and I did a Mr. Rogers segment while Mike was making a big change in the last iteration of Things That Go Ding. So I'll be in Things That Go Ding.
Good. So we'll see you on stage, which is
yeah.
Excellent. Well, it is so good to get good news coming out of the Skylight, to hear that you're positive about what has happened this past year, positive going forward. I think the shows have been wonderful this year, and I am so looking forward to seeing what else you come up with.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad. I'm very glad. Thank you.
And Ray Jivoff, it's such a pleasure.
It's a pleasure, Bonnie. Thanks.
Ray Jivoff is the artistic director of the Skylight Music Theater, and he also directed their current production of Urinetown. It's on stage at the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward through June 10th. There's more information at WUWM.com.
That freedom, son, that freedom.
We'll take one last break, and then we're joined by our film contributor, Dave Lurson. He'll talk about the latest addition to the Star Wars franchise, which takes a deep dive into the history of the Han Solo character. That's coming up when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm afraid you have to run, 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 run away.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. The latest in the growing Star Wars film franchise hits the screen today worldwide. Solo was directed by Ron Howard, who took over the production midstream after insurmountable creative differences arose between the film's producer and the previous directors.
The film focuses on the backstory of a young Han Solo, although this movie has as much in common with classic heist films as it does with sci-fi. Our own Star Wars aficionado, Audrey Nowakowski, sat down with film contributor Dave Lurson to break down what's good and bad about Solo.
Dave Lurson is the arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express newspaper, and he's our regular film contributor. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about Solo, which opens today.
Not content to produce a set of trilogies, Star Wars mastermind George Lucas has encouraged the proliferation of side stories and backstories, a virtual universe of space-age myth. The latest addition to the saga, Solo, a Star Wars story, counts as a prequel to the original 1977 film. It's the origin story of Han Solo with a glance at the rebellion's origins.
Solo, a Star Wars story. What was your first impression?
Well, I enjoyed it from the get-go. It certainly gets off to a fast start. It throws you into a particular world, a very unpleasant one, looking like some of the worst squalor in our own planet currently. The Han Solo character in this movie is a young man, maybe even 20 years old, perhaps. A petty criminal. There's nothing much else for him to do there. He and his girlfriend, Kira, dream of escape. He wants to be a pilot. They want to get out of this horrible place. And we have a flying car chase, I guess, at the beginning of the movie. Lots of action. The pacing is quite good. It's swift but steady, unrelenting but not exhausting. I think that with a few, you know, loose ends in the plot line as things were constructed, I think the movie works very well.
With standalone Star Wars films, of course, we don't have the crawl that sets it up. But we did get a bit of a setup with the classic blue text that, you know, Star Wars is affiliated with. Do you think this was sufficient enough to introduce that first part of the story, or were you expecting that to have a greater impact on the movie as a whole?
Well, I'm assuming that like most people who would see this movie, we know who Han Solo was or became later on. We probably know that this is a movie about the young Han Solo. I mean, I think the word is out about that. It works, I think, to construct the character, the boy who became the man Harrison Ford would later memorably play. The film does give us many of the pieces of the puzzle, I guess, of what constituted his personality, of why he was the way he was. And it works well. I don't think that you need an enormous amount of back knowledge to get into the film. But if you are a Star Wars fan, I think you'll be captivated by the ride that the film gives you.
Yeah, it kind of leads into how he is a survivalist yet with a heart.
Well, you know, I think about the Harrison Ford character as being influenced by the Humphrey Bogart character from Casablanca. I don't think I'm wrong because George Lucas was a great fan of Golden Age Hollywood. So you have the same kind of idea there. The idealist hiding his heart of gold under a very thick skin. He's been disappointed by a number of things, including love, but also politics. And at this point, particular point in time, as Casablanca begins, as the original Star Wars film from 77 begins, he doesn't want to stick his neck out for anybody anymore. And that will change, of course, because he does have ideals hidden away, and circumstances will lead him to fulfill that. And so in Solo, we do see how this type of character developed. He was, hurt in a number of ways and disappointed in the course of this movie. The movie ends optimistically in a certain sense, but, I mean, it's not without all kinds of bumps along the way for Han Solo.
Right, and compared to the other, trilogies of Star Wars movies where you have battles against, big political forces, this is about many more social issues about how these big political forces affect the people on the very bottom. So there's more social issues about slavery, gangs running things, the empire and their control, and also you get droid autonomy. Well, things like that, which I thought was a great thing by the character L3, voiced and played by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Right,
the militant droid who, instead of providing a kind of comic relief, but not in the sense of earlier Star Wars movies, I mean, she is, militantly in favor of equal rights for droids. And we also get kind of a pansexual implication, perhaps, between her and Carissian. So it's a fascinating kind of a thing. The movie really looks at harsher realities without becoming a dark movie somehow. I mean, it's brilliantly toned in that kind of way. You don't leave this feeling you've just been to an Ingmar Bergman film or anything of that kind. I mean, but the movie, against the backdrop, of all the fast-moving action scenes, shows a very dark galaxy, not unlike many of the worst aspects of the world we live in today, with enormous squalor, with human trafficking or humanoid trafficking or whatever the case may be in a film like this, enslavement, exploitation, the power of criminal gangs to manipulate social conditions, and, of course, the empire promising to bring order to all of this, but really benefiting from much of the chaos.
Along with the darker themes and the struggles that the characters are put into, I also really liked that the cast was more diverse in the human sense. I mean, obviously you have aliens, you have droids. Star Wars is a plethora of different characters. But I feel that the more and more new films that are coming out, this was the first Star Wars movie with a solo black female lead character.
Right.
Things like that. And some of the characters revealed towards the end, you see just the wide range.
Well, I was thinking about this same issue while watching the film and reflecting back on the late 1970s when Star Wars came about. And I'm sure that George Lucas, meant no offense to any ethnic or racial group, but he just didn't think in these. Most people in Hollywood and most people, I suppose, most white people in general were not really thinking about this. You may have supported civil rights and equal rights and voting rights, but how to implement the details of this in the everyday professional life and personal life that you were leading, this is something that has taken a few decades.
With the cast, if we expand upon that, first off, let's start with the young Han Solo himself, Alden Ehrenreich. And at first, when I heard about this movie, I admit I was a little trepidatious because I was like, you don't need to make a young Han Solo movie when Harrison Ford is still the living legend. And he's very much, this is his character just as much as Indiana Jones is his character. But I was really impressed with how he adapted the mannerisms. And you can see how this was, okay, I'm convinced this is the young Han Solo.
Yeah, I think he did a very good job. I've seen Alden in movies, but he never particularly left an impression on me until Solo. I think that he does have a good future ahead of him based upon his ability to inhabit a realistic earlier version, a prototype of a very well-known character that was played by a very well-known actor ahead of him. So the shoes are kind of large to fill. I think he did a very good job. As to why do we need a young Han Solo movie? Well, I guess why not? I mean, the Star Wars thing is being, explored, perhaps exploited in some cases from a number of directions. So again, why not look at the origin story of this particular character? You know, it could have been a disaster, as with anything else, but I think that the screenplay and at least the final direction by Ron Howard, as well as the cast, I mean, they pulled it off.
We'll touch upon Ron Howard's takeover, but before we do that, I want to touch upon Donald Glover's portrayal of Lando Calrissian. When, you know, he's a central character introduced in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, but, you know, we don't know much about his backstory then. We knew him and Han were buddies from back in the day, but I really enjoyed Donald Glover's portrayal and, you know, his highlights of Lando's, you know, eccentricity, his love of capes, you know, all these little details that I found really enjoyable.
Oh, Glover is marvelous, smooth as silk and just as slippery in his role as Lando. Great performance by him. I mean, I have to say that the whole cast of supporting characters were quite good in this movie. But yes, he's another interesting case here where we didn't really know much about him. It's a story that waited to be told, and now we have a pretty good sense. I mean, who was this guy? How did he get to know Han Solo? Under what circumstances? We get to learn about the Millennium Falcon, where that came from. You know, going down the line here, we could check off a whole bunch of boxes. Where did Chewbacca the Wookiee come from? How did he enter it? Well, now we know.
Yeah, and the new actor who took over the role of Chewie also did a great job in, you know, taking over what is a classic role in a dynamic duo.
Yeah, although I don't want to mean any offense here. I suppose in some sense it's a little bit of an easier part to play. I mean,
not as much facial emotions.
Right. Yeah, you've got to get the vocal inflections correct. But yes, I mean,
the subtle mannerisms.
The subtle mannerisms
were set by Peter Mayhew.
Right.
So with Solo, a Star Wars Story, it was a difficult movie to actually get to the big screen and an expensive one because it was set to be directed by Phil Lord and Christopher Miller. And with mere weeks left on shooting schedule, Kathleen Kennedy brought in Ron Howard to take over the project. And of course, we hear the term creative differences mm-hmm. in a multitude of ways. But that was another thing that led me to be a little cautious with this movie was the fact that it switched directors so far into production. But ultimately, 70% of the shoot and direction is Ron Howard, and he saved the day. I mean, he's a veteran filmmaker.
Well, he must have worked very quickly pulling together 70% of the shoot here. The flaw of the movie, I mean, there's really, I think there's one scene I don't like, the giant outer space octopus, I think was kind of a stupid-looking thing, and was the one point where I think the movie dragged a little bit. We didn't need that. Added 10 more minutes, kind of cut that out. I mean, the only problem that I think, you know, is inherent in this movie, and I would have to see it another time to kind of map out the flow of the plot line, I think there are some moments that don't quite fit together. And that's probably because of the enormous rush during which Ron Howard completed and reshot probably a lot of this film. So given that, though, he did a great job. Usually, I would agree with you about being apprehensive about this kind of thing, because normally this is a red flag of a project that's fumbling along. It's headed toward the, you know, going off the rails altogether. You're trying to scrap together, you know, salvage something that's about to turn into a train wreck. This was certainly not a train wreck. It was a fast-moving train that got to its destination. So hats off to Ron Howard for pulling it together. Exactly what the creative differences were, I'm not really sure about that. I'm sure this will surface.
I just heard inklings that they wanted to improv a little too much and veer away from the script to really make it a new and fresh movie. But this had the solid script written by Lawrence Kasdan and son Jonathan Kasdan, and Lawrence goes all the way back to Empire Strikes Back. So you're talking about someone who inherently knows the vision of Star Wars.
Yeah, and I think that is apparent in virtually every scene of this movie. I mean, I feel that this movie delivers what a Star Wars fan from the beginning of the whole saga would want in a Star Wars movie. I like it much better than The Last Jedi, for example. I mean, some of the recent movies have, I think, kind of done that and, you know, veered a little bit away from the tone, maybe. of Star Wars while keeping within the story. I don't think there's anything wrong with that necessarily, but I think from the standpoint of purely enjoying one of these movies, keeping to the George Lucas spirit is not a bad idea.
Exactly. Well, as more of these standalone Star Wars films are made, the more diverse settings and worlds will be available, because after all, it's multiple galaxies that are available, all these infinite number of planets that could be explored. And just as Rogue One does not have, you know, the classic lightsaber fights, the thing that we associate with Star Wars, it still felt like a Star Wars movie and had this good balance. So do you think that people will still be yearning for more?
Well, unless this movie does badly at the box office, I would imagine we'll be seeing a 30-year-old Han Solo coming up pretty soon. Maybe Alden will play this character with a little, you know, makeup to make him look a touch of gray or something. I don't know, something to make him look just a bit older than he is in this film. And we can keep the story going, I mean, as the pieces all sort of seem to be converging. So I'm not detecting any flagging in appetite amongst the public for these kinds of movies. I think Star Wars is going to be with us for a long time.
And I'm very happy that it is. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express newspaper and our regular film contributor. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about Solo, which opens today. And that's the Friday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Joy and I produce the show along with Mitch Tyke, Audrey Nowakowski, and Madeline Andre. We get additional support from our departing intern. Claudia Delgadillo has done some amazing work over the spring semester, and we're sure that this is not the last time that we'll say her name on the radio.
We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz and studio engineering from Jason Reavy. Michelle Matternowski is managing editor, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.